right now, Lord God, that they might sound their voices like a trumpet, and that all over not only this country but the world, people may hear. As we declare, Lord, that it's time for change, time for justice, time for reform.
You see how long it was to have that knee on his neck.
Thousands of mourners gathered in George Floyd's hometown of Houston, Texas, Monday for a public viewing ahead of a private funeral service later today. Former Vice President Joe Biden attended and spent time with Floyd's family. He is expected to record a statement for the service. The Reverend Al Sharpton spoke on behalf of the family amid calls for police reform and a complete overhaul of racial inequality in the United States. This in the midst of massive protests that have erupted in response to Floyd's death.
None of these family members asked to be an activist or a leader. They've been thrust into a role they did not ask for. So we are standing with them as they are now become the forefront of a new wave that I think will change policing in America forever.
Many of those attending wore masks and t-shirts reading, "I can't breathe." Floyd's funeral will be held later today, followed by burial, where he will be laid to rest next to his mother. What's happening has gone beyond the borders of the United States. Large protests against racism and police brutality in support of the Black Lives Matter movement have been taking place throughout Europe and further afield. AP correspondent Karen Schmoss reports.
I can't breathe. The last few words uttered by George Floyd before his death have resonated around the globe. In London, thousands of people congregated around the US Embassy for the second day running. In Rome, protesters held a peaceful yet noisy rally holding placards that read "Black Lives Matter and it's a white problem." One protester standing outside the US Embassy in Hong Kong noted that George Floyd's death affects everyone.
It is a global issue. People around the world will be looking at the US and thinking to themselves that obviously Black lives don't seem to matter that much.
The demos in Rome, London and Hong Kong came a day after largely peaceful anti-racism protests took place in cities from Australia to Europe to the US in response to the May 25th death of Black American George Floyd. I'm Karen Shamas.
American protesters are calling for defunding or abolishing police forces in order to stop police brutality and racism. Already, the Minneapolis City Council has announced plans to disband its police department. For more on what's behind the call to defund the police, VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to Scott Hechinger, who was a public defense attorney in New York City for close to a decade and now directs Zealous, which is an advocacy organization working with defense lawyers and the communities they serve. Here's part of that conversation.
I think a lot of people, maybe most people, even might think the idea of any city, let alone a major one, existing without a police force. And they might think about this as shocking. But as a public defender for close to a decade and seeing what I've seen, I think it's far more shocking that we've continued to allow our governments to invest billions annually in what has been a failed strategy that undermines public health, that fails to solve crime, that inflicts generational, emotional, and physical violence on predominantly Black and brown communities. And on top of that, doesn't even make communities safer. The reality is that police are just not very good at doing what we want them to do, which is solve crime. We've tried reforming police. 2014 through 2016, we went through a whole round of reforms that are continuing to today. Things like body cameras, calling for police accountability, calling for more training, the Department of Justice coming into states and investigating and overseeing local police forces. And these reforms just don't work. I think we need, and I think more people are starting to realize, that we need a page one rewrite. There's fear about what that looks like, but people are not being kept safe now. I think the downside and the risk would just be keeping the status quo.
Looking at some of your personal experiences, why do you think that it is necessary to defund or even get rid of police departments?
I think of the young 19-year-old boy in court who I was representing, literal tears in his eyes, scared to go to his corner store to pick up a sandwich for fear of being harassed by those same police again, stopped and frisked. I think about all those black eyes, scratch marks, broken bones, ripped clothes, and bruises, and the lies that police over and over again tell to justify their excessive use of force. I think about the big lies, like the 43-year-old Latino man who I served, that officers claim tried to run them over with his car and then was charged with a violent felony that could have jailed him for 15 years if investigators on my team didn't get video. Or I think about the 51-year-old black man who had a gun literally planted on him and he faced the same amount of time and was jailed pre-trial. I think about every single one of the thousands of people I met, and the majority of people are coming through the system arrested for things that arise out of substance abuse disorder, from poverty, from homelessness, from mental health issues, who would have been better served and communities better helped if better addiction and mental health services, poverty alleviation, affordable housing existed instead of the billions spent to policing public health issues. And lastly, I think about the dangerous lack of accountability. So I think about that police officer I cross-examined in one of my first trials who literally laughed when I asked him how many times he had been sued. The bottom line is what I have seen and what I've heard and what my colleagues have seen and heard and experienced of the people we represent, it's become clear that American policing is just broken beyond repair.
In your view, what would a world with defunded police or a world without police look like?
So let's talk about the two different kinds of, quote unquote, crimes. So you have, first of all, the vast majority of people who are coming into the system are charged with crimes that directly arise from substance use disorders, mental health diagnoses, poverty and homelessness, or a combination of all the above. And although we've been ingrained to think of police and criminalization as the answer, they're just not. And so these issues require what's being proposed now in Minneapolis, which are medical professionals and social workers, not criminal enforcement, or armed officers. That also includes the second big class of crimes. So people often will say and are saying right now, well, what about the serious crimes? What about the violent crimes? Violence is a public health issue that can be treated with public health techniques. There are actual models. In Chicago, Baltimore, New York City, California, Philadelphia, there have been these public health techniques, it's called violence interruption, that in the context of gun violence, for example, have seen extraordinary success. It includes, first of all, street outreach workers instead of law enforcement. The outreach workers are trained and are also part of the community to go into communities and work deeply with them to identify conflicts, mediate conflicts, and prevent retaliatory violence, and also change norms around the need to use violence. They also provide comprehensive support like job training and cognitive behavioral therapy and the support services. So this is deeply rooted in this idea of restorative justice, of first of all, not only responding after violence has already occurred, but disrupting it and preventing it before it occurs in the first place.
VOA's Jason Patinkin speaking with Scott Hechinger, director of the advocacy organization Zealous, working with defense lawyers and the communities they serve. Meanwhile, during a roundtable discussion with law enforcement officials on Monday, President Donald Trump said police officers are getting a bad rap.
There won't be defunding. There won't be dismantling of our police. And there's not going to be any disbanding of our police. Our police have been letting us live in peace.
During the meeting, Trump said he is looking at policing reforms. Democratic lawmakers Monday worked on a bill in response to the mass protests that have denounced the deaths of George Floyd and other African Americans at the hands of law enforcement. Before getting to work, though, there was a moment of silence for George Floyd. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
We are here to respect the actions of the American people to speak out against that, specifically manifested in police brutality. We are here to honor George Floyd.
Joining us to talk more about the proposed legislation for overhauling police procedures and accountability is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Catherine, before you tell us about what is being proposed, describe to us how lawmakers honored George Floyd Monday.
So it was a really unique moment in what's been a week full of unique moments here in Washington, D.C. Congressional Democrats from both the House and the Senate went to Emancipation Hall, a fitting spot for a tribute to George Floyd. And then they knelt. Most of them knelt on their knees. And remember, these are very old lawmakers that we're talking about, some in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. They knelt for that full 8 minutes and 46 seconds in memory of George Floyd. And watching Nancy Pelosi stand up after those 8 minutes, you could tell that she was very visibly moved and that it had really affected her to really understand that, having knelt for that full amount of time. And the visuals, of course, of it were quite affecting, too. The Congressional Black Caucus had handed out kente cloth, which are traditional African garb that signifies an important or historic moment. And all of the members, regardless of ethnicity, race, whatsoever, they were all wearing it as they knelt and they memorialized George Floyd. So that was a very special moment in the U.S. Congress.
And then they got to work, specifically on the issue of police reform. Can you tell us what they are proposing?
They're proposing a wide range of policies that really represents one of the most significant efforts on criminal justice reform and policing reform in a generation on Capitol Hill. And all of that is to say that while Democrats are proposing these big, bold ideas, they're still in a way stuck between these two sides in the United States. One, the defund the police side, which Nancy Pelosi has really been dodging questions about. She has not wanted to say whether or not she supports that movement, saying that there are other issues that can be worked on in the meantime. On the other hand, Democrats are going to try and get all of this big picture legislation over to the Republican majority U.S. Senate, where really, in an election year, just 5 months before a presidential election, it really doesn't have a chance of passing. Their best bet is to kind of break up some of these policies, building a national database of problem police officers, defunding this militarization of local police forces. All of these ideas, if they break them apart into smaller pieces of legislation, might have a chance at being debated in the Senate. Just because public opinion on this has shifted so dramatically in the last 30 days, the sense here in the United States is that this really is a moment where some of these big picture changes could happen, even though there are Republicans in the U.S. Senate.
But if the Senate couldn't even get through an anti-lynching bill because of Senator Rand Paul objecting to something like that, which you would think could easily be done, how could all of these other potential reforms occur?
Well, I think that's really where you look to how quickly this moment is moving in the United States, how quickly public opinion polling has shifted, even in the past few days, seeing these nationwide protests.
VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. In Minneapolis, where George Floyd was killed, a judge kept bail at $1 million for a former police officer charged with second-degree murder in Floyd's death. During the 11-minute hearing, Derek Chauvin appeared before the judge on closed-circuit television from the state's maximum security prison. He wore a mask and handcuffs as he sat at a table where he answered yes or no to routine questions. Well, not since the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s has the United States witnessed such a massive outcry for racial injustice and inequality. The masses pouring into the streets, demanding action and accountability, say George Floyd's death was just the breaking point in a long list of Black American deaths at the hands of police, as well as 400 years of racial inequality. Joining us to talk more about this moment in history is Karen Gray Houston, journalist and author of the book Daughter of the Boycott. Thank you so much for being with us. As an African-American woman growing up in a family heavily involved in the civil rights movement, your story is so relevant. So tell us a little bit about how this movement compares to what happened in the 50s and 60s.
My book starts with a case of white police brutality. There was a man named Hilliard Brooks, who was a friend of my father's and, like my dad, was also a World War II veteran. And he tried to get a ride on a bus in downtown Montgomery back in 1950. A police officer was called because he had been acting drunk and disorderly. However, when the police officer arrived, he took out a gun and he shot and killed that person. This is how it differs from how people are responding now. My father and an AMVETS commander at the school where they were teaching veterans, a Catholic black Catholic school, decided to write a letter to city officials, to the mayor, and to the police chief and say, we want that police officer prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. Well, that didn't happen. A white police review board found that it was a justifiable shooting. And so my dad and this other gentleman, they organized a massive march of veterans downtown in Montgomery, a march with a purpose. They carried signs that said ballots will beat bullets, and they marched to the courthouse where people could register to vote. So it was really a very peaceful way of handling a very bad situation. This was 5 years before Martin Luther King actually even got involved and started talking about nonviolent civil disobedience. And back to that case, the marchers had an encounter with police, but it was a very peaceful one. A sheriff's deputy came over and said, hey, you guys have to put those signs down. And they basically agreed to put the signs down, but they didn't stop marching. Mm-hmm. And so there was none of the violence. There wasn't any looting. There wasn't any burning. Nobody mm-hmm. vandalized anything. What happened with that case of white police brutality was in keeping with the same kind of philosophy that Dr. King was preaching during the boycott, which happened 5 years later, nonviolent civil disobedience.
This is so deeply embedded into your life as a journalist. Were you shocked to see all of the fires and looting and violence and destruction this time around?
We have never seen anything like this before, but we've seen a cycle of excessive force by white officers against unarmed black men that for whatever reason continues to happen. As I was working on the book, doing my research in 2015, there was a whole rash of police brutality cases. I can't even name them all. And so there were protests then, and there were college students who were protesting. We didn't see the same level of, it wasn't quite the powder keg that things that erupted in this situation. But, you know, it happens and it keeps happening. And as I was working on the book, I met some people in Montgomery, Alabama I didn't know. I went to the neighborhood I used to live in as a little girl, and there were signs on people's lawns that said, justice for Greg Gunn. Greg Gunn was a black man who was walking down the street one night in 2016, and a white police officer stopped him. There was an exchange, an encounter of some kind, and the officer ended up tasing him, chasing him, beating him, and shooting him to death. That didn't get adjudicated until finally 2019. There were about 8 different judges. Some of them were found not fit to handle the case. Some recused themselves. Eventually, the white police officer's lawyers asked for the trial to be moved. They had a change of venue, and I thought the white officer's legal defense team thought that would be better for him. The case got tried in a rural town in Alabama, and a jury of mostly white people found the white police officer guilty, but not a first-degree murder. It was of a lesser charge of manslaughter, but it was kind of a surprising verdict for a place in the Deep South and very unexpected. And as I ended the book, it gave me kind of a glimmer of hope. And now this.
What would you say to the young people out there who say they're happy that the charges have been amended, and but that this isn't finished and they will stay out there? What would you say to them to encourage them to stay strong and keep fighting for the justice they believe in?
I think they should stay out there, and they should continue to march, and they should ignore the president calling for the military to come in and confront them. If they can keep their demonstration peaceful to get their points across, they are understanding that the looting and the setting things on fire isn't the answer, though. I had a conversation with a young man who went down to Lafayette Park across from the White House, and he says he's been involved in peaceful demonstrating, but that he has talked to some of the people who were doing the looting. What they were saying was that they felt that looting these big stores, it's like their way of getting back reparations that they feel that they are due. I don't understand that, but I think they should continue. I think, you know, you need more and better dialogue between the races, and what I'm seeing that's different now from what I saw in earlier demonstrations back in the 60s and the 70s is that the protesters seem to be largely a more diverse group, more in black and white people together. But what's more important than anything else now is getting people out to vote. Younger people and some of the millennials have had a history of not thinking that voting is so important. But if you want to make fundamental change, you've got to change the leadership at the top, and you've just got to get to the polls and make sure you vote so you can make a difference.
Karen Gray Houston, author of the book Daughter of the Boycott. After 3 months and 21,000 COVID-19 deaths, the deadliest in the nation, New York City slowly began to reopen on Monday. In what could be the biggest test yet of Americans' ability to keep the coronavirus in check, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo took the subway in Midtown Manhattan, where he cautioned people to wear face masks and use sanitizer.
All right, you have a mask?
Here you go. With the virus in check for now, stores there previously deemed non-essential were cleared to reopen, but for delivery and curbside pickup only, customers were not allowed yet to browse inside. Some of the other stores are following it. The American Civil Liberties Union says relatives of George Floyd and three other black people who were killed by police have joined some 600 rights groups to demand the top UN human rights body urgently convene a special session to look into a rise of police violence and repression of protests in the United States. For the first time in 75-year history of the United Nations, world leaders will not be coming to New York in late September for the UN General Assembly due to the coronavirus pandemic. An announcement is expected in the next few weeks on how the 193 leaders and governments will give their speeches on the future of the Israeli-Palestinian peace process is in question as Israel prepares to annex parts of the West Bank in the coming weeks. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas says he has ended all security cooperation with Israel. The Israeli army has stepped up its alert in advance of July 1st, the date Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the annexation will happen. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
From the West Bank town of Ramallah, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas made a dramatic announcement recently in response to Israel's plan for West Bank annexation.
The Palestine Liberation Organization and the State of Palestine are absolved. As of today, all of the agreements and understandings with the American and Israeli governments and all of the obligations based on these understandings and agreements, including the security.
Palestinians have already rejected U.S. President Trump's peace plan unveiled in January. Now they view this unilateral annexation as the most serious challenge to the peace process.
What annexation means in 2020 is that it's kind of like an acceptance of the might is right political phenomena, that if I have the military strength, I can force anything I want on the ground. Also, it's a clear indication from the Israeli side that they have ended an intention to negotiate bilaterally a settlement with the Palestinians. And that means basically closing the door or attempting to close the door on a two-state solution.
The European Union and other international bodies have made clear that Israel will pay a heavy diplomatic price as well for any annexation.
This runs counter to international law, violates existing agreements, and is not in line with international Security Council resolutions and Council conclusions of the European Union. For us, it's of utmost importance to uphold international law.
The Jordan Valley area, which Israel plans to annex, is already under Israeli security control. But the annexation itself sends an important political message, according to some Israeli analysts.
It is a political move, first and foremost, because it's about sovereignty. But we control the Jordan Valley anyhow.
But it's also beneficial from two aspects that have to do with security. First of all, by telling the Jordanians and telling everybody else and telling the Palestinians that we are here to stay, and this is a sovereign Israeli territory, not only just temporarily occupied, then the message to all those who have an idea of trying to push Israel out of there is that this is not going to happen. And people have to adjust to the new situation.
Yet annexation could spark a wave of Palestinian attacks on Israel, say some analysts, similar to the first and second intifadas that left hundreds of Israelis and Palestinians dead.
I cannot say for sure that we are going to face the third intifada, but I'm sure that we will face a response from the Palestinian side. I'm not sure about the Palestinian Authority, but from the Palestinian street, it will be something that will remind us what is the meaning of Intifada. This will be also a good platform for the Hamas movement for escalation, because they will say to everybody that they were right when they didn't give up on the resistance or the terror against Israel.
With the U.S. elections only a few months away, Israel is sticking to its annexation schedule. Leaders here speculate that if President Trump is not reelected in November, Joe Biden would not support their annexation plans. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
And finally today, Bonnie Poynter, founding member of the Poynter Sisters, died Monday at the age of 69. The four Poynter Sisters, Ruth, Anita, Bonnie, and June, grew up singing in church in Oakland, California, where their father was a minister. Bonnie is the one that shortly after graduating high school first pushed the others to move out of the church and into clubs to pursue a professional singing career. Her sister Anita said in a statement that the Poynter Sisters would have never happened had it not been for Bonnie. The quartet brought a unique fusion of funk, soul, and 1940 style jazz to their act. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Wunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Wunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all these skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
country, AU, African Union. Can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this, whatever?
Session 9. Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at UpfrontAfrica.